When you go on holiday, there is no finer achievement than doing absolutely nothing. Nothing on the beach, nothing by the pool. Walking kind of nowhere and chatting about nothing. As an Expedia member, you can save up to 30% when you add a hotel to your flight. So you can have a bit more money to go out there with great ambition to do absolutely nothing. Expedia, made to travel.
All right, I just got to vent to you guys real quick. I just want to know if I'm fucking losing my mind or not. What would you guys do? Hang on, let me buckle up because I just left scuba class, okay? And I know everyone can't relate to that because scuba stands for self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, which doesn't appeal to most humans, but I am going for it. So I took my first class. First of all, I did a 15-hour online course. I haven't taken a test in of any type of scholastic learning, any type of test in, oh, I don't know, 26 years. So that was very difficult. I had to study and memorize shit, and my brain just does not work very well that way. My brain doesn't work any way very well, especially this way. So I passed the test with flying colors. I get like an A, I average like a 93% on 5 tests that accumulate like 15 hours. So I'm doing great in my mind. I'm like, fuck yeah, it feels good to get an A-. And then I go, and this is how it works. To get certified for scuba diving, you gotta complete the online exam. Then you take an exam at the end of that. Then you got to go in and do one day in a swimming pool where you learned all the mechanics of how to use the equipment in a swimming pool. And then you do 2 open ocean dives, one out in Catalina, which is like, you know, an hour boat ride from LA, and then one out in the open ocean. Then I'm certified for life. I could scuba anywhere in the world. So I just like, fuck it, everywhere. I'm always traveling to these amazing locations. I'm like, I want to get in the water in there and swim with the fishies. Well, no, that means get killed by the mafia. I want to hang out with fish because people are so annoying and disappointing that it's time to go hang out with the aliens and the fish underwater. And it's very meditative. You know, it's like you're in an aquarium. It's all quiet. Gee, I wonder why they call this show Nervous Rex. And I fucking, dude, there's a teacher there who was cool. But then there was like, you know, like a teacher's assistant or like someone that works under the teacher who's in training. And there was a girl in this fucking class who I had to bite my lip 3 times because I was about to call her on her shit. But then I didn't want to make it awkward for the rest of my other 2 remaining days out on a boat in the ocean. So I bit my lip and I didn't say anything. Okay, so obviously this is new. We're in school to learn how to do scuba. So they hand you the equipment and they walk you through how to use the air tank and how to put on the apparatuses that attach to it, the breathing devices, everything like that, right? And so I'm standing there 30 minutes into the first class and I'm like applying what they just told us how to do. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing this right. And she says, yeah, you look like you don't know what you're doing. And I just looked up at her and was like, okay, there's strike one. Yeah, no shit, I don't look like I know what I'm doing. Why do you think I'm in this fucking class? Should I look like I know what I'm fucking doing? I came here to learn, teach me. Don't make me feel bad that, okay, that was one. Then you have to breathe into this apparatus a couple times into this. I can't even remember the names of shit now. I'm so flustered. So I get fucking, then I you have to like do a test. Breathe into the thing. I breathe into it twice. She goes, you don't have to breathe into it 1,000 times. And I get hot, right? Oh, I get hot. And I look at her. I said, I didn't breathe into it 1,000 times. I breathed into it 2 times. And she laughed and walked away. Now, you could say that maybe wants to fuck or maybe she hates me. I have no fucking idea. But I'm so nice to everybody that I'm tired of it. I was so nice to everybody in the class. I'm nice to fucking everybody. And this is the kind of shit that I get, right? And I don't want to sound like a douchebag, but I get recognized in this intimate little 8-person class. And I take a picture with a fan in the class. So now all of a sudden everyone knows who I am and it's weird. But this was before this happened. So then I go, okay, that's 2 strikes. I'm biting my lip. I'm not going to say anything. I just gave her that little retort of like, no, I breathed into it twice, not 1,000. So we're out in the water later. And I'm like, you know, you're learning how to use the equipment. You're in a swimming pool in Santa Monica and I'm in the water learning the fucking equipment. I'm in reverse. That's what that is. And I'm learning the equipment, right? And she says something else. Like, what does she say? She says something like, I can't remember what she said. It was the third one. And she said one other thing that was annoying, something about my equipment not working because I was doing it wrong or something. And I just sat there in the water and I was like, you know what? I could change everything right now and be like, you know what? You need to learn how to fucking talk to students because you shouldn't like to have this tone of voice. I don't know what this is coming from. I don't know what issues you have. And then I start questioning myself. I'm like, is this me? Am I wrong? Why am I feeling this way? Is this a trigger for something?
I'm trying to figure this shit out. And then you know what? I've just realized as I'm saying this to you guys, this is the whitest fucking shit ever. Like, am I really complaining about my scuba fucking lesson? Like, I hope you enjoy this episode. This is with the one and only Mark Ronson. Fucking, he can do no wrong, this guy. He's winning Oscars. He's winning fucking Grammys. He produced Uptown Funk. You know, Uptown Funk gonna give it to you. He's produced Amy Winehouse. He just won an Oscar for Star is Born for producing the main song with Lady Gaga. I've had the honor of being his friend for a long time and gotten to be in the studio with him and Gaga and be in the studio with him and Puffy, and he's just a legend. We go way back. I don't really remember what we talked about. This was in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, and I feel like I should have asked more questions about, you know, maybe his, what's your work process and what inspires you, but I just don't want to do those generic things. I'd rather just talk to someone and let it flow. So I don't really remember what happened. We just let it flow. There might be some, I remember the guy from The Roots, the main dude from The Roots was DJing right outside of the hotel room we were in, so it might be pretty loud. Why can't I fucking remember the dude's name from The Roots? He's the main guy. Really? See, okay, so this is where I think it's my brain. Let me Google this. Roots main guy. Roots main guy. No, not the movie Roots. Fuck. Roots music. Oh my God, my brain's broken. Roots music group lead man. Really? Really? Oh yeah. Black Thought? No. Who's the lead singer of The Roots? Black Thought. No, Questlove. Okay, Questlove was DJing outside. Oh, continue the whiteness. Questlove was DJing outside, and we actually had a moment in the elevator because he was DJing at the same place that Mark was DJing in Vegas, and I was in the elevator alone with him. And he actually, one time on the Jimmy Kimmel show, which he's the band, the house band for Jimmy, not Jimmy Kimmel. Fuck. Oh my God. Who's the other dude? Oh my God, dude. Who's the other guy with the late night talk show? Not Andy. Holy shit, dude. This, kids, don't smoke weed. I haven't smoked weed in so long, but this is permanent fucking weed damage from all the years. I can't remember. Not Jimmy Kimmel. What's the other fucking dude's name? God damn it. Anyway, he's on one of the late night talk shows bands, and he played My Dick, which is a song I produced. My Dick, big and the theme song to this fucking show you'll hear in a minute. He played it with the live band, and I was going to say to him in the elevator, hey man, nice to meet you. You performed a song that I produced on your show, but I just left it alone because I didn't want to like bother him. I got the vibe from Questlove that he didn't want to be talked to in this long elevator ride. It was like, you know, a fucking 40-second elevator ride. So I left him alone. Yeah, sometimes you just want to leave people alone. I got that vibe, you know? So anyway, I hope you enjoy this episode with Mark Ronson. I don't have any memory, as you can see, about what we talked about, but I hope you enjoy it. Suck your own dick. Welcome to Nervous Rex. I'm sitting here with the one and only Mark Ronson, and if you hear in the background the sounds of music, that's Questlove DJing at the pool. Mm-hmm. At what hotel are we?
We're at the Nomad,
which is part of the bigger hotel. It's
part of the Park MGM. It's the boutique-y wing.
So we just took a steam. We're feeling very Greek.
Yeah.
I'm feeling very Greek.
For some context, I just came here from London, and Simon landed. Then we went and watched Questlove DJ for 5-10 minutes. It was wonderful. We would have stayed longer. It was just very hot.
It was hot. And I was telling you, I was just saying, I'm not a big Vegas fan. No offense, Vegas. It's just not my vibe. Are you a Vegas guy?
What's funny is, because like when we used to come out here when we were kids, because me and Simon have been friends for like more than 20 years, like you weren't more Vegas-y, but Vegas was like closer to us because we'd come out for like there'd be like these snowboarding kind of sports clothing expos, and you were like a little bit in that true. World. You would like host these things, or Run DMC would be performing. I remember one or two things like that.
That's true.
Like yeah. before Complex Con, it was like whatever that would have been here.
Wait, what's is Comic Con or what's
Complex? No, Complex Con is like their thing for like streetwear. Cool. It's like there used right. to be like Magic and those things.
It was called Magic. And yeah. Anyway, big conventions. Yeah.
Big, like, and Ben, we would come and we would just raise hell. I remember.
I think I'm older because I just can't deal with the loud
yeah
crowd.
And it was also not this, it was just so fun and glitzy, and it was like honestly it was just like us feeling like kids in a place we shouldn't be. And then it was strip clubs, and then I remember running around the MGM one time with like your boy Adrian Brody, and like it was just like a funny, I just think of us as like kids, like
we were kids
being chased around.
I remember us here for your bachelor party.
Yeah,
and that was how many years ago?
I'm living in that painful memory.
There was it was a fun weekend, and what thought reminded me of it was your boy Danger Mouse, right?
Yeah.
The funny stripper story when one of our friends who will remain nameless was waiting for him out front as he was leaving, and he was like waiting for the stripper, and he like basically like rolled his bag up. He's like, she's not coming.
Yeah, bro, you need to go upstairs and go to bed.
Dude.
Our friend was who we won't say his name, was like, had obviously told his stripper and like had a bit of a romantic connection or whatever. It was obviously his first time in a strip club.
And yeah, the girl, he thought that she said, liked him. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess she maybe did, because like she came back to the hotel, but he was waiting. And
no, she
like,
never came back
she
to the
came,
hotel.
But she came like a day late or something. She did eventually come, but he was standing in the lobby waiting for her to show up at 5 a.m. At the meantime, like Brian was like, who had just come in for the night, was like, had his rolly bag, was on the way to the airport, and just looked at him and just like ashamedly and just looked at him and was like, bro, you need to go upstairs and go to bed.
The sun was up. And if you've been to Vegas and you've ever watched the sun come up, it's a very creepy feeling. I've only watched the sun come up. Very rarely now do I watch the sun come up. I did it in Ibiza recently and I embraced it. There's certain places where you can embrace the sun coming up in your 40s where it's not as guilt associated. Yeah. Like in LA, that ain't happening. I'd feel cracky. But like in Ibiza, once a year, you pull an all-nighter and you're like, it's okay
don't
once in a while.
Don't you wake up to do like yoga with the sun breaking and shit on the ocean?
I mean, that's
though?
Normally what I do now. But I mean, right. I'm stalking,
so
stay up all night partying.
Oh,
yeah,
mean,
I mean, stay up all stay night. Up. Okay. You know, when that guilty feeling when a jogger goes by and you haven't slept and you're like, ugh. What am I doing
oh
with my
God,
life?
That was like my entire like early 30s. It's so yeah. embarrassing. And I would have to like, I'd be like, and let's be honest here. I would be up all night. I'd realize like I had to walk the dog. It was like 7 a.m. So like I'd have to walk the dog and just like with this like shameful like gait going around Washington Square Park, just like hoping I didn't run into anyone I knew. And like occasionally you'd see like some girl you haven't seen since high school and you're just like, she's pushing her kid in a pram. Oh. You just feel like such a screw up.
I know that feeling all too well. I remember.
This went dark quick.
No, it's okay. It's going to get dark and it's going to get bright and everywhere in between. I feel like we survived a pretty, it was fun. There was a lot of light and there was a lot of dark. I'm going to go back a little bit and tell people listening that me and you were friends in New York City back in the 90s that's when like hip hop. Yeah. Yeah, so let me explain to people that might not know. We met at a Calvin Klein show. We were both modeling in. We somehow, this
you
is before.
You were a
this
legit
before,
model. I was like accidentally street cast, which I felt like they sort of regretted the minute that they like, I actually showed up on the day.
But street cast are always the cooler ones. And you had blonde bangs, and you just graduated.
You're just
going to
grab us a water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, grab us water. I'll
down.
Keep telling the story. So imagine Mark with bangs, maybe 21 years old, just graduated Vassar. Is that right?
Dropped out of Vassar.
Dropped out of Vassar, which is a college. And he had a band. He was in a rock band. And he had, like, blonde bangs, very 80s Depeche Mode haircut. And me and my buddy, Ethan Brown, kidnapped Mark and brought him back to our apartment on 14th Street. Where we were freestyle rapping, and we kind of made Mark freestyle rap with us, and it wasn't his thing. He was like, oh, who are these guys? Anyway, we ended up becoming friends. And then we survived the New York in the 90s, which was a time when...
I remember you guys got me really stoned, which because I didn't smoke weed, but I wanted to be cool. There was like a cypher going around. I don't know if it was that time, but it was like around that time, so I'm eating cashews. And you guys passed me the mic, and I like made beats and stuff like that and DJed a lot, but I certainly like... I didn't know anything about rapping, but I was like kind of stoned, and you just like it was like in the cipher, and I just started going like, "Fish and chips, yo, fish and chips, yo." That was the only
yeah,
thing
very British.
That.
And then you and I stayed pretty tight. We We had a lot of crazy memories. I was Selector Simon for a while, which would mean that I'd select records. This is so old. This was before cell phones and social media. This is like pre all of that world, when even before Giuliani took New York and sort of stripped it of its raw elements. And you would be DJing, and yeah. I'd carry your records for you, and it would be kind of like a friendly competition between all your friends of who got to carry Mark's records into the club so they could access the funnest party of the night, because you were, you know, DJing the cool parties for Puffy, whoever at the time, which was like the shit.
And people would confuse us a lot, even though you were more handsome and buff, like that was like always like our funny thing, like. And we would always come up and, should we just reenact it? So okay, yeah. So say someone pretends. Comes up and goes, oh, are you guys brothers?
Oh, no, we're...
You're not related?
No, I can't relate to him at all. We're of no relation.
Yeah, I can't relate to him at all. It was like literally like we got asked so much that it became like a bit of a shtick.
Well, and I remember one time Puffy, Sean, I didn't know what... let me tell two stories. Puffy thought I was you and came up to an event and was like, hey, let me get your number, because he thought I was you. And I gave him my number, but I wasn't you. And I knew he thought I was you, and I still gave him my number. And it was this weird moment. Then cut to 10 years later, you're working with him in the studio and you bring me by and you guys like previewing. I remember the song was whoa.
Oh, really?
That was like that had just come out, and you guys were like, Black Rob was in the studio or something.
No
and you
way.
And you
I
said to
remember.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
And you said to you introduced me to him. You're like, hey, this is Simon. And I reached out to shake his hand. And in that moment, I thought, do I call him Diddy? Do I call him Puffy? Do I call him which nickname is he now? And I go, nice to meet you, Sean. And he just looked at me like you were looking at me right now, like, how dare you call me my real name? And it was just this awkward moment. You kind of looked at me and like laughed it off. And it was like, and I was like, I'm that guy.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That happens with people that have like weird, like artist names that like, I find that sometimes like if I'm out or if I'm like see people do that to Lady Gaga, they like, or if she's on like the red carpet, they think if they yell out like Stephanie, it like, it intimates this like fake sense of like, I know you, like, and she just, like, hates it. She's like, nobody calls me Stephanie except, like, you know, my parents or some shit, bro.
She introduced herself as Gaga when she came to your house, Ricky Schroeder's beach house I came to one night for your birthday, and I hadn't met her, and I thought, how cool she is, because she staggered in these, like, Christian Louis Vuitton high heels that were getting wedged between the floorboards, and she just threw, like, 20 joints on the table, like, here, have at it, and just introduced herself to everyone. It was more socially open and friendly than someone who, you just would think someone of that level would be more introvert. Like, she was
the
nicest,
chillest.
Coolest, famous person.
She's the chillest.
That I've ever met. She just seems seriously really down to earth.
And you came on, though, just because we're going to go all over the place.
We're all going to go all over the place.
So much history, but we had that whole New York era, then I was sad because you kind of moved back to L.A., and then you were blowing up with the Dirt Nasty stuff, and I was such a fan, and I'd pass around, like, the Champagne Fady mixtapes to all my friends.
Yeah, Champagne Fady was
by the stripper.
Yeah. Bubbles.
We would memorize all the lines and sounds like I'm Argentinian, and then you came on tour because Dirt Nasty already became this like big thing in the States. In England, it was starting to like just at the beginning, like, you know, internet people sharing stuff on MySpace, and like it became
a bit like
more,
05,
like,
06,
viral.
Yeah.
And then 07, you came on tour with us on our first big tour in the UK. And I was like, Simon, you got to come over and like open for us. It's like Dirt Nasty. And like you did like this first show in Bristol.
Yeah, I'll never forget.
And, I mean, come on. It was hilarious.
And I remember you being relieved because you actually, I didn't know this till later. You had a sigh of relief after the show went well because you're like, honestly, I didn't think they would like you as much as they did, because there was kind of some hoodlums were in the front.
Yeah, like Bristol's like a little tough, like, you know, it's not like, and there's just, you know, music fans, was like a 3,000 person venue, so not like we were like some like punk or mod band, like, but I didn't know how it was going to go. And then you used Stuart Zender as a prop to like bring out a big bowl of baking soda.
That's right. We would do a cocaine bit. That was a lot of fun, that tour. That was with Wale, right, when he was kind of blowing up. Uffy, remember? Uffy was not on the tour, but she was in London. We all met up.
Yeah.
And that tour, I just remember saying, wow, what a cool tour bus. You had this really interesting European tour bus that I'd never seen before. That was like, and it was Sean Lennon. Who else was on the tour with us?
Daniel Merriweather.
Daniel Merriweather.
Alex Greenwald.
Alex Greenwald.
Maybe Kenna. Was Kenna around at all?
Kenna, I don't know if he was on that tour.
Wale, then the band with Stuart Zander and the Haggis
and
Horns.
How about when Wale introduced me and he forgot my name, so he goes, "Give it up for my boy."
Yeah.
He didn't know my name was Dirt Nasty, and I just had to walk out after being introduced as his boy.
Not as bad as the time Q-Tip introduced Kid Cudi as Wale at his first New York performance. I remember that. That was so long ago.
So you and I, God, we have so many crazy memories. You're talking about watching Dirt Nasty blow up. I've got to watch you blow up from afar and see sort of the... It's crazy. It was almost like, I remember when you won a Grammy for Record of the Year. Is that technically what it was? That means like Song of the Year. Like, it's so
Right. They're two different things. So, not to be a dick, I've actually won it twice. But Record of the Year, one's for Rehab and one's for Uptown Funk. Record of the Year goes to the producer and the artist.
Okay.
It's like for the record, you know, like for the actual... the sound and the performance. And then Song of the Year goes to the songwriter.
I see.
So sometimes they're not the same
And you
person.
Won both?
No, I've won Record twice. Okay. Once for Uptown Funk and once for Rehab. I've never won Song.
Let's tell... Okay, and yes, obviously... I'm sure people listening know all the stuff you've done. I want to say how cool it was that you would bring Amy Winehouse around back in the day. Do you remember how much of a fan
she
was?
She was a Dirt Nasty fan.
Oh, she was an Andre Legacy fan, too.
Well, she liked the whole thing. She liked My Dick. She knew all the words. She appreciated anything. It was, like, clever. And, like, she got, like, the layers of it. And we were in... She just really loved the music because I think I must have introduced it to her while we were working on Back to Black. And you guys were playing a gig at Don Hills while she happened to be in New York. And there's definitely no music out yet because she could just walk into Don Hills. Like, nobody made a fuss over it. It was definitely before
she
Back
to
Black
Soundcheck.
Came out. Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. She hadn't blown up yet.
It was before Back to Black came out. But, no, and then she came. I went home, but you guys like hung out all night.
Yeah, hung out. We stayed up all night in Brooklyn at Kimian's and stayed up all night. And she was such a trooper. She slept on the floor of my boy's apartment in Brooklyn. I never forget. I slept next to her on the hardwood floor in the winter. There was no bed. We just ended up passing out. And we both, it was just like she was one of the boys. She just passed out on the floor. It was very, very low maintenance, cool chick.
I think of all the times I actually woke up on the floor in our house in Camden and like, shows me so she'd be like, "You all right, Mark?" And like stroke my hair and like get up. She was fucking cool.
Yeah, I remember her showing up to soundcheck and she had just gotten a tattoo that throughout her career I'd always see like it was like on her forearm and it was one of her first kind of like her beginning of her getting a lot of tattoos. And I remember it was kind of always symbolized that night because she was like, "Mark, bring me to soundcheck. I want to meet these guys." And she was the only one with you at soundcheck. Then she came to the show like by herself or with us, partied with us all night. And
no, I came to the show.
Oh, you
too.
Came
I remember
to the show.
Being at that
oh,
table.
You
we were
at
all
home.
There.
We went out. Right, right. Yeah.
She actually, man. I remember too, like, because I used to do that East Village radio show and there was a tattoo parlor next door. So I'd do it every Friday at 8 to 10 at night. So whoever I was working with in the studio that week or that day, usually would either like come to the show with me because it was just like a fun place to hang. And I remember the first time Amy's like, "Yeah, I'll come with you," because we were working together. And then she got a bit bored after 20 minutes and she just like wandered out the door into the tattoo parlor next door and then came back with the tattoo. And I think that happened like two Fridays in a row till I just decided to stop inviting her to East Village Radio because I felt bad that she was just getting tattoos all the time because she was just bored.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, I remember her coming to soundcheck and she didn't have a lot of tattoos. It was before she was like, there was a buzz going on, but you guys hadn't blown up yet, but you were excited about her saying, "Oh, she's one of my new projects. She's going to be great." Now you always seem to have like a new female. You seem to attract or you're attracted to female pop vocalists. Would pop be the right genre? I mean,
I think it's just soul jazz, soul, whatever it is. It's all, it doesn't really matter. I mean, all that, like from, like, I guess I've worked with some like extraordinarily like powerful women for sure. I mean, also men too, Bruno and Rufus and whatever else. But like, there's something about the women. I don't know if it's because of, I just was really sort of more like raised around women or what it is, or there's a connection there or something that I'm trying to fix from my childhood. Who the fuck knows? But Yeah, but like I guess genre-wise, especially on this new record, which is by accident, but it's all female vocalists. So it's King Princess, Camila Cabello, Leaky Lee, Miley Cyrus, Alicia Keys, Angel Olsen. Yeah, but like it's, excuse me if I'm forgetting anyone, Diana Gordon. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel like this is the most emotionally vulnerable record I've ever made. It's actually the first one of my own records where I even put myself into the lyrics and that kind of stuff. And I, these were just the people that were like exciting and around, and that's kind of what it is.
Yeah, so I didn't even think about it when I just said it, that you tend to work with female artists. Seems to be kind of your, seems to work. It's a formula that works for you. All female vocalists on this
album,
one.
Yeah.
And you wrote some of the songs?
I wrote all of the music, or co-wrote all the music with everybody. King Princess kind of like wrote most of her song. I added a little bit. Angel Olsen, the same thing. But everything is kind of like, and it is this breakup record. So the thread through it, this emotional tone, like everybody was willing to go to this slightly more melancholy zone. Because, I mean, I guess most of my records usually like, if you think of Bang 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 or Uptown Funk or Ooh Wee, like they're like party records. I came up as a DJ. And
right.
To be honest, who wants to like, I, or this is what I thought in my mind, like who wants to hear what the DJ's feeling? Honestly, like you really want to hear a DJ in the nightclub, get on the mic and be like, I had a tough day today. No, you just want to party. But I also right. think that like it probably has something to do with the fact of like not being very emotionally open anyway, like fucking at any point in my life, really, up to more recently.
We were just talking about this in the steam room. Having a little therapy session one-on-one, because we don't get to hang out as much. So when we do, we just kind of go right to it. I feel like when we see each other, we catch up and get right into the deep stuff. And I think it's kind of parallel to that time of our life. We were just partying and didn't care and weren't even having these types of feelings or thoughts or even looking at things this way. Now we get older. So it seems to make sense that at this point in your life,
yeah,
you're kind of, you know, having more deep.
I think I was just probably emotionally pretty closed off at the beginning of my life, you know, wherever that came from, childhood shit, whatever. And, you know, saw the breakup of my marriage and a couple of other things happen that I started to have to think like, wait, I haven't really got this right. And for me to just be like, oh, I must be unlucky in love is like a very naive and immature reaction. It's like, no, you actually have to look at the root of this shit, which is yourself. So it feels like a good thing to be doing. And anytime you're like proactively working on yourself, whatever it is, like how can that be bad? It's definitely.
Yeah, I think I'm on that path too. I've been doing a lot of things that I used, like I've become exactly what I made fun of in the introduction to the 1980 music video. I said, no, I've been doing good to getting in tune with myself, you know, getting in touch with mind, spirit, and body.
You know, smoke, you sound like a little weed. Bit.
I've become that, and it's okay, and I don't care. Like, I've become sort of a cliche, but I'd rather be that cliche than the other cliche, which is...
Yeah, because one cliche is going to, like, make your life better, and, like, of course. I even felt like that, too. Like, you know, and, like, I always fought moving to L.A. a little bit because it just... I grew up in New York. I was born in London. It felt like L.A. was always, like, the sun was shining too much. I don't know. I just had all these judgmental things about it. And the minute I moved here, of course, I'm like, learn meditation. I go on hikes. I wake up at 6 a.m. and like my life is so much healthier. But like, there's a reason that some of those, like some cliches are a cliche. They do kind of, they do work for people.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to laugh at it until you do it. And then you're like, oh, there's some truth to this. I want to bring something up that I always defend you on, which it's not a big deal at all. But people just want, like when you're on top, I think people want to find something to say or somehow make a negative out of a positive. So a few times I've heard people come up and say, oh, Mark, what the British accent. Dude, I'm like, he's born in England. His whole family's British. I've been around him and his family all the time. When he's around his family who speaks full British accent, his accent comes out. I defend you all the time. I want to put a rest to this that you're doing some Madonna fake accent as if you weren't from England.
No.
You're British. You're half British, goddammit.
I'm full British. Full both British. Of my parents. Yiddish, British.
Everyone.
I moved... Well, thank you for telling me that a lot of people I didn't know about have a problem with me. That's good to know. Also, I know. And because I moved here from England when I was 8, and you know, kids make fun of you like mercilessly at school, regardless, like if you're wearing the wrong color sneakers. So if you come with this funny accent. So I think I really tried to ditch it quite quickly, just as a survival mechanism and whatever. And then I would go back to London to see my dad like twice a year on holidays. And then it would sort of come back. And then in 2006-07, when I really started to go back, because most of the music career and stuff was taking off over there, and I started, and then I lived there for 10 years, it really came back. But I know it's, I would listen, if I had my choice and there was like one accent that just like I could have the whole time and it wouldn't bend, because even sometimes I hear myself and I'm like, dude, it sounds like it's so schizophrenic, you just switch your accent like twice in like a 20-minute spell. But I just realized like I can't really control it anymore, and it's not. There's probably more important things to get like bummed out
but
about.
But that's exactly my point. Is that like, first of all, if that's all anyone's got on you, like that's awesome. I don't think people that know you, no one has. You're one of those guys. One of the few people I know that nobody's got a bad thing to say about you. Like across the board, anyone who knows you is like, I remember like our friend Mike that I introduced you to after hanging out with you was. Calls me up and he's like, dude, are you serious? And I'm like, what? He's like, Mark. I'm like, oh, what about him? He's like, he's like the nicest guy of anyone at that level. He's like undercover cop nice. That's what he said. Really? Which I don't think you realize it, but you've maintained your humble ways and you're the exact same dude I met when you were 21 years old with, you know, your little bangs. And it's refreshing and nice to see someone come this far and not change, because I have seen a lot of people come not nearly as far as you and let their ego get in the way. And like, even right now, like, I don't want to, it doesn't matter, but you have a couple books on the table that are like very intelligent, self-reflective, you know, hyper-cognizant and self-analyzing books that I think you keep yourself in check pretty well.
I think I got better at it. I think that definitely. You just see the people that aren't like that or like turn into assholes, and there's two things. There's probably people, I don't mean to judge anyone to call anyone an asshole, everyone has their own shit, but I wonder if there's the kind of people that sort of turn that way once they get famous because they just feel like they have the leverage to, or the people that were always that way like in hiding but now they have the platform to be that way. And I've seen it happen a lot too, and you just wonder like, why would anyone want to be that? It's because it's almost just more defeating to be that cliche. Like, it's like, right, you're going to be that thing that like we've seen for like hundreds of years and everybody always bitches about. Like, it's just so, it's like more predictable as well. But yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You know, some people, it's funny because some people act like that and it's not even warranted. You're like, well, you're acting like you're some type of famous rock star and you haven't even earned that. So I can only imagine if you got famous and power and money, what you'd be like. You'd be a monster. But just saying, I've seen other people, especially like in Hollywood. I think it's probably because you have a good family. Like, I know your family, and I think you have a good family structure, and you know, you have a lot of love around you, your sisters. Like, you guys have a good core family structure, good friends,
good values.
Yeah.
And just like, and crippling low self-esteem. So that's great. Yeah. And so being, who am I to be the asshole in the room? I don't even deserve to be here.
That's what I think you just hit on it. Like, I think I wonder if that's a Jewish thing to kind of like,
self-deprecating thing. Yeah, that can be a little bit, but that can be deflection. It can be like a comedic tool. It can be like a way. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know if it's specifically Jewish, but it definitely tends to like. I see it as quite a common thread through a lot of my Jewish friends. There's something. I wonder what the anxiety gene is. You know.
Yeah, I wonder if it's nature or nurture, or if both. Maybe it's a little of both. I remember hearing, I did a movie once and the line was, I feel if I don't laugh, I'll cry. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like how I feel like as being a, because I'm not religiously Jewish, but like if the Jew, like I feel like the Jews had to laugh in the face of adversity and be equanimous. Is that the right word? It, like somehow still in the eye of the storm and not because
we've had, so,
yeah. Because it's like if you don't laugh at it, you're gonna fucking melt down. It's almost
that's
like
laughing,
it's like
that's stiff. That's one thing too, and that's important. But self-deprecation is even like a more. It's something about when someone else brings attention to like a positive quality in yourself or something good that you've done, you feel the need to instantly deflect it because you just like don't want to be the center of attention.
You do that all the time.
Or something like that.
Because I'll compliment you and I'll, it's funny, like you'll try to diffuse it by saying, oh, dirt, but you like, I'll.
But to be honest, I used to do it a lot. I try to do it a little bit less, not because I want to be more of like, an asshole, but because it's not genuine to always just deflect. Like sometimes, like if someone says a compliment, you look nice today, we've been working out, whatever the fuck it is, just like accept and be like, yeah, don't be like, oh you think, oh, this old bones, like whatever, because that's even a little bit more annoying because that feels ingenuine. So
right,
I've just been trying to be like a little more truthful.
Yeah, good. Yeah, living in the truth.
I got a song on the album called Truth that I didn't actually write the lyrics to, but it's one of my favorites on there. It's with Alicia Keys and Dodger, and it has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's just called Truth.
And that's on the new album.
I just thought I'd do a shameless plug. Yeah.
So wait, okay, so the new album is titled, forgive me, what's it called?
Late Night Feelings.
Late Night Feelings. Yeah. That could mean a lot of things.
Well, that's exactly right. So this is sort of a, you know, it is a DJ sort of like melancholic, like a bit of a breakup record, but it like it's very dancey and fun. And I guess I was writing, one of the first songs we wrote was this song Late Night Feelings with Lee and this songwriter named Ilse that I work with a lot on this album. And we were messing around with it and trying to think of lyrics to the chorus, and they had this melody, and Lee K was like, what about Late Night Feelings? And I just loved it instantly because it sounded kind of like emo and more like a rap lyric, like a kind of Kanye-y Drake, like not necessarily like...
Right.
And I thought it was just interesting because there's a lot of things that I think of that those 10 minutes when you're lying in bed just before you fall asleep. It could be, you could be thinking about, you could be missing someone in your bed. It could be lust. It could be worried about fucking Trump. It could be like longing. It could be like just before you fall asleep and you start to have those slightly delirious thoughts and you're like, wait, am I dreaming yet? Like there's just this kind of vibe around it. So as soon as she said that lyric, I was like, oh shit, that'd be a cool album title.
And my mind went somewhere totally different. Late Night Feelings, I was kind of thinking about what we were talking about earlier, like when you pull an all-nighter and the sun's coming up and you're like, what am I doing with my life? And you're like,
that's
looking
true.
In the mirror and the sun's coming up, and you're like, you're feeling shitty about yourself. That's even early morning feelings. That's how late night they are.
Yeah, but that is the same thing that you could be having if you were sober and going to sleep too.
Yeah. So you've gotten to work with some of the, like, at this point, I don't know if there's anybody you can say, I'm sure you get this generic question all the time, like, if you could work with any artist, I mean, you've worked with Stevie Wonder, you've worked with Paul McCartney, you've worked possibly Hall & Oates coming up, which, as you know, I'm very excited about, and you know my incident with a Hall & Oates CD back in the 90s at a record shop on 6th Avenue in New York.
I never forgot it.
It's almost like you were there. You know when you hear a story that sticks with you so much that you feel like you were there? That's one of these ones. See, I'm going to tell the audience, I went to buy Hall & Oates. I can't remember if it was Biggest Hits or like that. Their one album with all the hits on it. I think it was like, what was the album with all the jams?
It was called One to One or something. I don't know. There was a Greatest Hits album.
Right. Yeah. Okay, maybe it was the Greatest Hits. And I remember going to buy, this is how long ago it was. It was a CD and it was used. And I went to buy it in this hipster at the time, 90s kind of emo downtown.
It wasn't a tower on Sunset in LA.
No, this was in New York.
I had it in my head. Okay,
no,
okay,
this
okay.
was in New York.
Okay.
So it was a real hipster. And I remember he scoffed and laughed as I put Hall & Oates, and he looked at the CD and looked at me. He's like, Hall & Oates? And like laughed. And I got so hot. I got so mad. I was speechless to the fact that he would judge a customer's taste in music and be so wrong. And I told you about it and you got mad. And now.
I just think
it's Hall & Oates, man.
Yeah, I mean, also history reframes everything. Like they might have been like maybe just because they were so big in the 80s, and a lot of things that were big in the 80s got a bit of a blowback in the 90s. Like, well, whatever, Seattle's going on. But the things that, and I talk about this because one of my favorite bands growing up was Duran Duran, and I actually got to like work with them in the more recent years, and you know, I obsessed over them. They were another thing. Like some of the excesses of the 80s were like not as trendy in the 90s, but you know what like holds up more than anything? Like good fucking work, like the legacy of good work. So you know, now you go to a Hall & Oates or a Duran Duran show, you know, it's fucking all ages. It's just like, it's some of the best music ever made. It's like, who cares what's like, if it's not ironic or enough to be hip in this like little pocket of time, like Duran Duran have played fucking Coachella. So Steely Dan, all these things that like aren't supposed to be cool. And I love watching that happen because it just shows like, you know, it endures more than anything, like just making good shit.
I feel like we had the 80s as kids. We're the same age. We're both, I think I'm older than you. I'm 44. You're 43 or 44?
43.
Okay. You have the body of a 42-year-old. And we were both grew up in the 80s. And I feel like, was it that we were kids and we had the 80s for like film and music at that time was so special? Because like you could turn on the radio in the 80s and like pop music was like Prince, Madonna, fucking Hall & Oates, like even like the shit that was like mainstream radio was amazing.
No, it's crazy. And also if you think about it, because they're so legendary, you think about them being older than they were, but if you think Prince was 24 when fucking 1999 came out, like wow. That shit's flooring. Like he's the same age Justin Bieber is now or Shawn Mendes. Like that's fucking crazy to me.
Yeah, that is crazy, because when you're a kid, I don't think you understand it's just an adult to you. Like they, 24
and
or 40
and they're just like always like kind of older than you. Like, yeah, no, it's insane. Duran Duran were like 24 around that time. Like, just, yeah, there was great pop music. And I have a lot of theories about it because I like obsess nerdily over this shit because it's just like fun to think about. The 80s was this era when technology changed so much with all these kind of like digital reverbs and samplers and things that you could do that you couldn't do 5 years ago in a way that maybe in 1979. There wasn't like technology so crazy that you couldn't have done something in 74, but the 80s especially.
Right.
So you had these new glut of bands coming that were like embracing this kind of like sounds and samples. You had
Roland Prince, drum machines, 808s.
Yeah, Prince with the Linn drum. Right. That classic sound from Prince and everything and Erotic City. And Duran Duran using like the reflex, flex,
right.
Like all these kind of big gated reverbs. And
that new wave sound that was incorporating the new type of, so it wasn't just acoustic pianos. And you're right, it had an electric element that was parallel.
A little digital, a little tinny, but hold on 1 second.
Yes? Oh yeah, can you come back later?
We're doing a podcast. It's called Nervous Rex. It's called Nervous Rex. Thank you. Tune in every Wednesday. So 80s, man. It was the best. And the music,
Now not going to get clean till Wednesday.
So wait, the music is obviously synonymous with our childhood. So to us, it's special. But if you were to separate yourself from that and just listen to
it. No, it's still great. I still prefer music for other eras that I wasn't even alive for either. But there was something I can say about the 80s, which is really, really special.
Like even like, I guess, Afrika Bambaataa and rap music being born in that decade.
Were listening to Bambaataa when you were six.
What I'm saying? Like it existed and I got it later. Or like I remember like Michael Jackson and Prince coming out like within the same time. And all of a sudden, like everyone loved Michael Jackson. And then all of a sudden Prince came out with Paisley Park or whatever the album was called. And then I remember like, oh, it was cool to like Prince instead of Michael Jackson. You had to pick one. You couldn't pick both of them.
You had to pick one.
And it was like, that was the beef back then. It was like Prince or Michael Jackson or like Depeche Mode or The Cure. Like there was just this.
Yeah. In England, it was Duran Duran or Spandau Ballet.
Really? Was it Spandau Ballet?
In the early 80s, for sure.
And then you have your one-hit wonders like Ain't Nothing Gonna Break My Stride. Some of the one-hit wonders are the best songs ever made.
They're really
Who
good.
Who sings that song? Can you tell me that, Almanac Mark?
Christopher something. I can't remember.
That's a great song. If I ever need to get going in the morning and I want to like get in a good mood, Can't Nothing Break My Stride, that's one of those songs that just makes me feel a type of way.
That's great.
So you've worked with all these people. You kind of, like, at this point, if there was one like rapper or
dead or alive
say alive, because you really could access this person, rapper or even any musician, who's one that you want to work with?
I mean, there's nobody that like it's keeping me up at night like, damn, I wish I could work with this person. Also because all the people, and obviously at this point I work with a lot of great people, it always just happens like if it's supposed to be. And I feel like by saying it sometimes it feels a bit dirty, like I'm trying to like force it into the universe. But I mean, obviously, like I would kill to do a track with Kendrick because, you know, he's maybe the greatest living rapper or whatever. But
right. Do you feel he is, or that's because everyone says, is he the best rapper?
I feel like
I mean, he is
making
the dude.
Records now. Like, I don't think I'm not counting Jay and Nas and anybody who's still alive. I just mean that maybe of this current
right
of the last
now,
10
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I love, like you said kind of earlier, like, I love finding new artists in this thing too. It's like, it's exciting to me. So, like, anybody who's good, and just because I love somebody too, it doesn't mean that I get in the studio and maybe, like, do something good with them. Like, I don't know if I have, like, the thing to do, like, a great track with a rap or whatever it is.
Right.
Like, usually my stuff does work better kind of for singers. But there's a lot of producers that I really love, like Metro Boomin and a couple of the new, like, that would be interesting to me, like, getting to make a project with, like, one of the new, like, younger rap producers.
Yeah, because, I mean, maybe the people that don't know, they might only know Mark Ronson, who's kind of done these, you know, last few years, these really big records that you actually, what I know you from is, like, your New York Knicks MPC making hip hop beats for, like, yeah, Saigon back in the 90s, yeah, and you're, like, straight hip hop, yeah, Beat Nuts at your house. Remember, was that their name, Beat Nuts?
Well, the Beat Nuts were at my house.
Oh, but no, they were at your house. Really? Yeah, you lived downtown, and Rashida was there, and you had a party, and it was your birthday, and Beat Nuts were there, and we were all freestyling. The group, they're from Queens.
Yeah, oh, so I'm not in the studio.
No,
working,
but they were at,
hanging
at your house, okay, hanging out. But I'm just mean that era, like, you were a hip-hop head.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's how I came up. That was everything.
That was everything.
And then and obviously that was, like, DJing hip-hop in these clubs, and that was what, like, laid the foundation for everything. But I didn't, of course, at first, I was just trying to, like, imitate my heroes, like DJ Premier and Pete Rock and Q-Tip doing beats, but I was never going to be as good at them as just straight making beats, so it wasn't, so I started to incorporate some of the more, like, little things from, like, used to play guitar in a band, so I put a little guitar on it or do these things, and then I started to find, even though it took me a while to make it good, then you find your little toolkit that you assemble that makes you different from everybody else. So I guess that's why, like, I've always, like, worked with singers who have, like, a little bit of a leaning towards hip hop in the groove. So, like, obviously Nika Costa and people like
even Bruno, Amy, she was a hip hop head.
Amy was a big hip hop head. So it's like, they're, all the records I've really worked on are probably heavily, heavily influenced by hip hop, but probably not good enough to just be a hip hop record in a way. I mean, I guess the people I've made rap tunes with are like ASAP Rocky, like we did Every Day, and Action Bronson, but those are people that kind of like to go a little left in their music too.
Right.
I think that's what it is.
I remember Action Bronson previewing the song that you guys did. I was over at Alchemist Studio, and Alchemist is Action Bronson's, you know, sidekick on the show. Fuck That's Delicious, and a very famous New York producer, or LA, but based out of New York for years, producer. And I remember I came over once, and Action was sitting there, and he was crying. And I was like, are you okay? Like, I was genuinely concerned. I'm like, you all right? And he looks up, and he was crying at the song that you guys did. And
he loved it so much.
Baby he was
Blue
like,
with
I can't,
Chance the Rapper.
He was like, I can't believe, like, this is me on this song, and this is, like, I'm a part of this. And he was genuinely, like, crying.
That's
but
so
it wasn't
sweet.
Like that might
no,
sound.
Just having, he
no,
was he, just having a real emotional moment, like, this is my voice.
Like, he's like, this is yeah, crazy that I'm listening to something that's this dope that I'm a part of. And it was, like, just me and him in the room. It wasn't like, and it was just, like, a cool moment. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. Him and my boy Mark made this banger, and that song is fucking amazing. I wish people could, there was a way to, like, possibly explain what it was like when you'd be DJing at Life or those clubs in New York in the 90s, back in the day, downstairs at, you know, what was some
at
of
Life.
The, at Life.
Yeah.
Like, that time when a record would break, it'd be like you and Stretch Armstrong, and, like, if you wanted to hear the new shit, you'd either have to go get a mixed tape on Canal Street, yeah, or you'd hear it in the streets. There was no internet. There was no way of finding out yet. You'd break a record by whether or not, like, the very small DJ community would think it was dope. And I remember, for instance, the first time I heard Mobb Deep was outside of Don Hills through a brick wall, and I just heard that famous intro for Shook Ones, and I just heard that murky, like,
yeah,
filtered thing. And I run inside. I'm like, what is that I'm listening
to?
And Stretch is DJing, and he takes his headphones off. He's like, it's Mobb Deep. And I'm looking at the words,
yeah,
Mobb Deep on a record, turning around.
No,
like,
it was crazy.
And I'm like, Mobb Deep? He's like, yeah, isn't that a great name? And, like, that's how you found out about a record.
I remember hearing Enough spin Made You Look for the first time, which is still one of my favorite hip hop beats of all time. And Enough's one of my favorite DJs. No, it was crazy. I remember the guy who did all the street team stuff for Bad Boy Records back then, this guy Henrock, would he would go to the big clubs, obviously, because like Funkmaster Flex would be playing for like 3,000 people, and that was important to service. But if you wanted the downtown cool spots where the tastemakers sort of were too, maybe 500-600 people in the club, that's where I played, you know, Stretch played. So he'd bring us these acetates of like Hypnotized for the first time. Like you would play it for this room, and you could like feel the blowback when that first boom, like the whole room. Wow. Maybe they had heard Flex premiere that night, but really maybe the third time they've been able to listen to Hypnotize. It was so like tangible. And then also at Life, the DJ booth was like shoved up next to the stairs. So you could kind of see, like, even though I was DJing, I'd see over my shoulder everybody coming down. So you kind of get a kick out of like, oh shit, and they'd walk past you like their little booth or banquet. You'd see like Chris Rock, Prince, Mariah Carey. And I remember there'd be nights where like Jay-Z and Damon Dash were like on this one table to the left of the booth, and then on the other side of the room there'd be Puffy and everyone at their booth, and I'd play one Rockefeller song, one Bad Boy song back and forth for like an hour. They're all just like, yeah, like giving each other shit, and like it was just so insane.
I can't believe I got to experience it, because it's almost like that's our 60s. It was like us, New York in the 90s. Yeah. We had that window. That was it. It'll never be like that again for hip hop, for New York City, for it, that was it. It was, and we didn't know at the time that was it. You're just like, you're not aware. It was just, it was everything.
I mean, it's obviously even like now being, because I met a kid who was like 21 who grew up in New York. He was like an actor. It was like over this Seder. He was on the show Life in Pieces with my friend Zoe. She had a Seder at her house. And
wait, what's a Seder?
Passover dinner.
Oh, I'm such a bad Jew.
You're a bad Jew. So he was like, I was telling him about something. I was like, oh, New York, where'd you, he went to LaGuardia High School or something. I was like, yeah, I had some friends who grew up. He's like, man, I can't believe you grew up in New York in the 90s. Like, yeah, nobody in the 90s said like, yo, can you believe we're here? Like, just like in the 60s, no one said, can you believe we're here in the 60s?
Like, well, you know what's crazy? Now looking back, like the 90s was right after the 80s. It's like now from 2000, like 14 to 2007. Like if you do the math, it's like the difference between the 80s. It
calculating.
It's
do
so
the math.
Fucking weird.
And also, like, it's being fetishized already a little bit. I mean, obviously that was more of like a LA skateboard experience, but mid 90s, you know, and this thing of a Mobb Deep, early Wu Tang, first Biggie record, Peak Tribe called Quest, like. These are now, to some people, like the foundations and cornerstones of like what's going on in music. So no wonder it's kind of like this period.
Well,
that was
looked back
at.
Would you say that's the golden age of hip hop? It was like 93 to 97, roughly.
It's called golden era.
Right.
So like, even if you don't think it's a golden age, golden era is now what everyone calls that era.
What's the era? 93
to
98?
93 to 98 or something.
Ish.
I mean, I remember going to see New Year's Eve, 1993 into 94, it was Tribe, De La, Souls of Mischief. And I remember them doing 93 till Infinity and thinking like, is that song going to be played out in 1994? Dude, they're still playing in 2019. Yeah. But I remember on New Year's Eve like being like, is it going to be weird to sing that song?
I remember you DJing a party for Puffy, Sean Combs, Diddy, whatever you call them, down on Wall Street. And I'll never forget this. You were DJing, and then some other DJ that was like
Kid Capri was like the headliner.
Kid Capri.
I remember
and
that
so
party.
You opened up for him. And then all of a sudden, Kid Capri gets on, and I watch. It was a fascinating thing in human behavior and how one thing that you're excellent at is you can judge a dance floor and gauge the energy and the people and what to play and how to move them. And I'll watch a dance floor go from not one person standing on it to when you get on, all of a sudden one person gets on, three, five, next thing you know, it's hopping. That's a magical thing to watch that you don't just understand as just like a DJ. You just think it's someone playing records. It's not. It's feeling out the room and playing it, and you're very amazing at that. And I watched Kid Capri get on. If it was him, it was some other big DJ, whoever it was, and it's no big deal, this is what happened. The floor dispersed after you were done, and the big DJ got on after you, and I watched Sean Combs climb the wall. It was like a gate.
It was
up
Cipriani's down Wall Street. It was like a very fancy kind of like a Greek like kind of palace.
He climbed
up.
So angry because he saw that the party was dissolving, and he's like, get Mark back on there. And he was like furious, but he wanted you back on, and it was like I had this proud moment of like, oh, that's my boy, he wants Mark back on. And then you got back on, and then the crowd got back on the dance floor. Yeah.
Dude, that's like that. You can't. I'm trying to explain it. Yeah. Like, you, unless you've seen it.
I know
it wasn't, it's magic.
I definitely
dude.
Wasn't kicking free that it's night. And I didn't know the story was going this direction, so I definitely don't want to. Like,
no, it wasn't. I don't know who it was. I don't think it was.
No, it wasn't him.
And it doesn't matter whoever it was. It just that's what happened that night. And I'm sure you've had off nights where maybe you didn't. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
Like it's. I don't think Kid Capri's listening, so we don't have to worry. But.
Shout out to one of the greatest hip hop DJs of all time.
So, dude, that era, man, that whole shit, like, I look back on it and it's almost like it's looking back at a movie or a dream or a TV show. Like, I was in that. Like, I remember Eminem coming up to Alchemist and them meeting, and I was sitting with Alchemist at some club, and Eminem just broke and he saw Alchemist and parted the sea. And I was like, that's Eminem, that's Eminem. And he came up to Al and, like, gave him props and was like, Alchemist, I fuck with you, dude, and walked away. And Al's like, yo, that's crazy. He came up to me. Cut to, he's his DJ now, 20 years later. Like, I was a part of this history. And at the time, working at MTV, I was so integrated into the culture of, like, music, television, film. But even if I wasn't working at MTV, just by proxy of being in your world and hanging out with you and your and you New Yorkers who took me in, I had the time of my life. Yeah. That was the best. Like, looking back, like, that was the era. Like, It'll never be. Is it that we're older or was it better? It's both.
I think it was a little better. I think that there's certain things that were better. I think there's no doubt that nightlife was better before smartphones because people are in their phone. If you went to the club, you were there for the night because you didn't have a way to like find out what else was popping or what was better. You were just going to go to the club.
Stuck it out.
Before the smoking ban too, I'm not saying anyone should start smoking again. You didn't have to go outside. So if you were DJing, you're looking in the club, you'd just hone in on this group of like five or six girls dancing and they'd be in that spot on all night. And you knew that if you lost them, you were probably doing something. You had to, you know, whatever. You probably fucked up, so you better get the crowd going again. Whereas once smartphones came in, everyone's kind of in their phone taking pictures, selfies. Everyone has slightly shorter attention span. The smoking ban, people going in and out of the club. And then the VIP booth and banquettes, which slowly started to eat into the dance floor until you go out to a club now and it's just a block of different banquettes and people dancing at their own things.
Yeah.
Holding up champagne glasses.
So like you've given this thought. Sounds like you've thought of this, and that's just, you're absolutely right about
it. I do, and
this.
I think about it. I don't know if I'm absolutely right, but I talk about it a lot with my friends who DJ from that era, and obviously now DJing being such a boon. I mean, here we are in Vegas because I'm DJing in a club tonight and playing with my good friend Mighty Mai, who we used to play at all those clubs in New York together, El Flamingo and all that stuff, Tilt, Indochine, like, or Undochine.
Indochine.
Like, yeah, we think about it all the time because we, like, I'm so grateful that I still get to DJ and still get to play in this era. And I never want to be like that grumpy guy. Like, I want to be like, yeah, I want to fucking evolve with the times so I can be relevant as long as possible. But there's times when you just do have to look back and be real and be like, it was probably better for these reasons. And I'm sure, you know, if like people now who are coming up DJing for the first time, they just came up in like the, you know, the 2010s, whatever you call it, like they'll be great and they'll have their own experience too.
Yeah, it's just, it's everything you said. And also, a big thing is the smartphones take people out of the moment because they're no longer living in the moment. They're just capturing a moment and then resharing it as it happens. And no one's, and everyone's acting on their best behavior because everyone's on camera. Where back then it was wild. Like motherfuckers would be standing, like a celebrity would be standing on the table wasted with a butt like that. You won't see that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember who, but
Cheetah on a Monday night. Like
Cheetah.
Mace and Aaliyah would walk in together. I mean, they were just like probably like 24, just like glowing like the king and queen of the prom of like music.
Wow.
Like, just so many moments. And
Tommy Hilfiger was sort of an aesthetic part of that, which we worked with. Tommy Hilfiger was like the outfit of the era. And we were lucky enough to work. You and I did the Tommy in the Jeans tour where we traveled across the country with Aaliyah, Kadada, Rashida Jones,
Kate Hudson.
And we just went across the country doing fashion shows in malls in a bus.
Shout out Kentaro Segal.
Oh my God, that was it. We did it. We went in a fucking tour bus across the country eating at Cracker Barrels. Fucking doing a fat Tommy Hilfiger fashion show in towns across the country. That was
we touched America. We left a real impression there.
There's something about. See, I still get to go into the trenches
Ethan
like
Brown's,
that.
Ethan Brown's. Fuck, we forgot about Ethan.
And
of course,
we didn't ever. Ethan Brown was the reason why I started working with Tommy Hilfiger, and you know,
that's we all met together. Shout out EKG, Ethan Brown. He was part of the, it was called the In the Genes Tour because the double meaning genes and genetics. And I was the only one, me and Aaliyah were the only ones on that who weren't in the genes technically.
You were just actually talented. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Aaliyah and I were the only ones who didn't have like a family name that was, you know, worked for that thing.
Me and Q-Tip did a fucking Tommy campaign like maybe a couple years after that. It was like in the studio and they're like, we're going to put this girl in it because she's this new pop star and she's probably going to blow up. We want someone like young in it. And I was like, who? And they're like, you don't know, her name's Britney Spears, but she's going to be there. And it was like, literally like, whatever. That's the story and relationship.
I remember how nice Aaliyah was. She was so cool and sweet. And
she did really like glow. She had an angelic thing.
It's okay. So we're lucky enough to meet a lot of these famous people that are stars. And to be honest with you, more often than not, I meet stars that aren't brilliant in person and don't have that thing that maybe is on TV or the media portrays them to be. Tupac was one of those people that I walked in a room and I never felt anything like his energy. Aaliyah had, there's a handful of stars that when you meet them in person, it goes beyond even your idea of what they are. Where you're like, whoa, okay, I get it. And then, you know what I mean? It's a characteristic that it's a charisma that you're just born with. I don't think that's a learned thing, because some people could be famous without that just for whatever reason. But I remember Aaliyah was just, she had something that glowed. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like she was just sweet.
Very.
She was so nice.
Spirit.
Yeah, the '90s, man. That's like the '90s, bro. Fuck, that's just so crazy that to some people listening to this, that's like when we were kids, their parents say in the 60s.
Yeah.
It was a whole different era. Well, tonight we get to see, I get to come be Selector Simon with you, like for the old days. And I'm not going to be a grumpy old Jew. And I'm going to have a good time. Okay. And I'm going to have a couple of drinks of tequila or something to really get in the mood, because I have social anxiety in my older years and I don't like crowds. So tonight we will relive the 90s. What else are we going to do? I was going to say, and we will fuck like men, but that there's nowhere to go with that, because I don't think we're going to fuck like men, and it sounded really strange.
To all the killers and the $100 billers.
Oh, man.
To real Jews who ain't got no feelings.
Mob Deep. Dude, I love you, Mark, and thanks for doing this.
Love you, bro.
And I guess everybody knows how to... I am Mark Ronson on Instagram.
I am Mark Ronson on Instagram. Late Night Feelings, the album out June 21st, please.
Yes.
And yeah, just check out some music on your favorite streaming service.
That's it. Thank you, baby. Thank you.